We're going to start with a public hearing on 971 today.
Thank you, Senator. In your packet is a copy of the staff measure summary in Senate Bill 971. What this bill does is it requires that insurance policies cover medical surgical expenses, also cover bone mass measurement. Establish that the coverage is for the diagnosis of osteoporosis and or upon referral by a healthcare provider, and annually for women age 45 years or older. Establish that the coverage is subject to the same terms and conditions as other benefits, and establish that the act takes place upon the effective date of the act, or that the policy is issued or reviewed by that date. And there is some background information on osteoporosis in your packet. I probably will defer to the people testifying and requesters to go over that.
Thank you, Senator.
My colleagues can but you can do things about it.
Betty Haas and Marcia Kelly, would you please come up?
Hi.
Would you like to introduce yourself and please?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Marissa and committee, I am Betty McChesney House, and I am representing Delta Kappa Gamma Alpha Rho State as their state legislative chair. Delta Kappa Gamma is an international honorary society of educators, and I am speaking in favor of Senate Bill 971. Several of our members were discussing health issues when bone density screening became the main issue. During this discussion, Madeline Lapp, state president from Roseburg, and Janet Walsh, our state vice president from Springfield, realized that their respective insurers had paid a different percentage of the bone scan that had recently been administered. When they did an informal survey, they discovered that there is a great deal of variation on coverage depending on where you live in the state and what level of coverage you have. They felt that an important diagnostic procedure should have better consistency in coverage. When we researched further, we also discovered that your income or job had a great deal to do with how your coverage is determined. If you had a low-paying or part-time job, you had basic coverage, which would have a high deductible or higher percentage for the insured to pay for the procedure. Women were at a disadvantage in many cases because they were covered under their spouse's insurance or had more time in their lifetime when they were not insured. Thus, when they became middle-aged and back on insurance, they did not undergo a diagnostic procedure unless they had a broken leg or other fracture. When they were referred, they often delayed the procedure in favor of a child's health need. Women are more likely than men to suffer from bone loss due to their smaller frames as well as the childbearing. Next page. In the United States, one out of two women over 50 have osteoporosis-related fractures. One out of four men also suffer fractures or dental problems due to bone loss. Bone loss begins in the average person between the ages of 35 to 50. Women age 50 or older that have gone through menopause lose bone at the rate of 1 to 6% per year. In 1 year, $18 billion is spent on fractures due to osteoporosis. There are 1.5 million Americans a year that suffer fractures due to weak bones. Fractures occur primarily in the wrist, spine, or hip. If bone loss is discovered early, there are treatment options to not only stop the loss, but to rebuild bone mass. Prevention and early diagnosis will save money over the life of the person. A healthy skeletal system with strong bones is essential to overall good health and quality of life. We would never want someone to miss a diagnostic procedure due to finances. This is particularly true since last Friday, the FDA approved a new drug to help increase bone density that needs to be taken only once a month. It is our hope that this very important diagnostic procedure can be affordable to all, no matter what level of insurance or location within the state. We hope that you pass Senate Bill 971. Thank you. I wanted to add one other thing, and that is that the Kaiser Family Foundation said that in our state we do very well on insuring women. It's 71.4% of the women are insured as of November 2004. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that good or bad?
It's really very good because then we're covered for a lot of different issues, and we're not, mm-hmm. we may be in some cases underinsured, but at least most of the women have some insurance, which is quite different from some of the other states. If you ever have time to look under the web, they have a whole, or I could give you the list, that shows us in comparison to all of the other states. And it's amazing some of the states that one would think are very, very good are very, very bad.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And after my testimony, I'll provide you not only with the few pieces of paper I did, but sort of the book that I book that I used or the papers that I used for preparing that report. Osteoporosis, in looking to put together the report that's required, is sort of a disease that it's hard to find some of the real facts and figures on. There are only about 13 states in the country that are really doing a big effort on osteoporosis education. Oregon is not one of them. And the most complete information that I could find about the expenses of hip fractures was in 1996. So there'll be information in there that's outdated, but there's also information on the percentage of increase on medical costs. And that's one of the concerns that we have. Whereas women have a lot of coverage in this state for osteoporosis screening, one of the things that has not happened is that we haven't discussed too much the threat to men's health as well. One in five men, as Betty said, will develop osteoporosis. And one of the things that's a concern to us, because, you know, we advocate for everyone in healthcare, is that men are more susceptible to death from hip fractures than women. About three times as many men die as a result of hip fractures in their later years as do women. And very rarely are men even screened for osteoporosis. With osteoporosis, your bones start losing some of their density in your 30s, and then that continues. And so one of the things that is the new emerging research is on men and osteoporosis, because until this time it has been treated so much as a woman's disease. The death rate for men and women from osteoporosis from fall deaths has escalated. Between 1998, when men had 24.3 per 100,000 deaths and women had 18.8, the death rate from accidental falls has gone up to 32.7 per 100,000 in men and 27.3. So that's one of the things that we should be concerned about, is that escalating death rate. And not only is it the death rate, but it's also the effects that having a debilitating fall have on seniors in their later years, because when they fall, they then sometimes become less apt to go out and socialize and keep up with activities in the world because they're afraid of falling again. The average cost of a hip fracture, just the hospital and the long-term care, discounting physicians' costs, is usually about $19,000 for one hip fracture. I'll be able to tell you a little bit more in a couple or 3 weeks because my mother-in-law just broke her hip 3 weeks ago, and she's now in the nursing facility getting physical therapy. So I'll probably have firsthand knowledge about costs in Oregon. So we think that we need to do education, and this is a way in talking about it. One of the other things, I've talked to the insurance companies. Kaiser covers it, Blue Cross covers it, and Providence covers it. I did not hear back from HealthNet. They're concerned with some parts of the bill, and if you wanted to move the bill, we would entertain amendments because they're concerned about mandating the exact screening, because right at this point they're still doing research to decide what should be done to screen men, as well as the fact that women probably do not need to be screened every year annually. And so I told at least Blue Cross Blue Shield that we would be happy to work with them for amendments. We think it's a health issue that needs to get on the radar screen in Oregon because we have an aging population. And with the report that I'll give you, we'll talk about the number of baby boomers in Oregon. So if you have any other questions past that point, I'd be happy to answer them if I can from my papers. But we just think that it's something that we really need to zero in on. In my bashing around doing research on medical statistics that I haven't done for a long time, probably since I first graduated from college, I discovered that last year, in 2004, the discharges from DRG hospitals in the state of unintentional falls were the number four discharge for DRG hospitals in the state. So it is a real concern in Oregon.
Well, it's good to hear that that amendments are possible to work out any differences with the insurance or with Blue Shield Blue Cross. So I appreciate that, and we will have that conversation, and we will talk with you and the insurance companies and see where we go from here. Good.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have just two questions. One is, how much does the cost of a bone density screening, how much does it cost? The second thing is, once you find that you're losing bone mass, what is the treatment and how much is that then? Because I know this bill just covers the screening.
The cost of a DEXA, and there's a little sheet on the DEXA, is usually between about $175 and $200. And the treatment can vary greatly. Some of the newer things out on the market have differing rates, and I'll have to get you that information.
Thank you.
The rates that I have found really vary from anywhere, as Marcia said, to the 200s, depending on what is ordered, up to as much as $750, depending, again, what is ordered and where in the state you are. As to the question of the amount of the medication, the one that is on the market right now my husband takes, and that's a once-a-week drug, and his bone loss is due to medication. So he has a different problem here, but it's the same type of thing. And it is fairly expensive drug. The one that's come out, I don't know what it's going to be priced at, but it'll only be a once-a-month drug that has to be taken for it. And many people, and I think Representative Boone said to us that when we had the bone scanning done last session, that she was found to lack bone mass, and her doctor put her on a schedule of some inexpensive medication plus milk to do that. So it just depends on what level you catch it at and how much bone loss there is.
As an educational tool, using this as sort of an education format, one of the other things is taking vitamin D along with calcium at the same time. And some of the newer research indicates that the more children drink milk and do exercise through their teen years, active exercise through their teen years, the less likely they are to develop osteoporosis. And so this gets back to some of the health bills that you're talking about with things in the schools. So
well,
I think we need to go for a real education in the state.
Osteoporosis is an aging disease starting at 30 years of age. And if you have exercise and pressure exercise, jumping and running and that sort of thing is what builds bone mass, and I think women are getting that more today than they were earlier. I mean, there are a lot of women activities, sports activities, but I know that you gain bone mass, you level out at about 30, and then you go level until you're about in the 40s, and then you either drop off rapidly or you kind of drop off slowly or stay even, depending on a lot of things. So it's something that I think needs to be looked at fairly early on, and some of it is hereditary, because in my wife's family there is a hit and miss of osteosclerosis in the women in the family over several generations. And that's a good warning sign that you better do something early in your life to prevent bone loss. I think it's something that needs to be looked at, because if it's, you know, if you don't pay attention to it early on, the other problem is the loss of calcium in your body, and there are certain things like cola that tend to leach out the calcium in your body. And I think that's something that a lot of, you know, that's been one of the reports made that I've read recently. And so there are dietary things and exercise.
Yeah. The genetic connection they're beginning to realize affects men, too. And so we're trying to do this on a gender-neutral basis, even if we are the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition.
Well, yeah. I think men don't have the bone mass loss as much as women, because of the nature of our society, men have been more physically active throughout their lifetime. It's expected of them to be more physically active, and women tended to be less.
And the fact that women are the childbearing,
that's exactly
an enormous amount of calcium.
The women as childbearers lose calcium. That is another contributing factor.
I do have here the report from the Surgeon General, and I'll add that.
Okay.
To the book.
Good. Thank you very much, and we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 971. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 374. Courtney.
Thank you, Senator. What you have in your packet is a copy of the Dash 1 amendments and engrossed version. And basically what that is are identical to the amendments that Representative from Regent Blue Cross and Shield submitted at the first hearing on the 24th. These were reviewed and concurred on by the both sponsor of the bill and the requester organization. Thank you, Chair.
Courtney, would you introduce yourself?
I'm Courtney Drexler. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society, and we are supportive of the amendments, of the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you. Okay. We will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 374. Senator Starr, would you make a motion, please?
Yes. Chair Morissette, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 374.
Senator Starr moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 374. Objection? Seeing no objection, Chair moves. Excuse me. Senator Starr.
Yes. Chair Morissette, I move Senate Bill 374 to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat your motion, please?
Chair Morissette, I move Senate Bill 374 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Pretty concerned. Mark gave me the gavel.
I have discussion.
Okay, the motion has been made. Is there discussion, Senator Mona Sanderson?
Thank you. I have a real concern about the high rising healthcare costs, and I know how important screenings are, but this is another mandate, and I feel when I take a look, this first of all removes the sunset, which I feel is not a good thing. Is that correct?
The dash one, Senator, removes the reference, so the sunset is back in.
Back in. Okay, good. And what about the emergency clause?
Senator, it does take place upon passage of the Act, or effective date of the Act.
Okay. The smaller health insurance companies had indicated to me that, again, this is another mandate, and they do cover, in most instances, I believe they do cover this, but the preferred provider organizations, as well as the health maintenance organizations, are not included in that. Is that correct?
I apologize, Senator. I'd have to probably defer to some of the carriers or representatives in the audience. I'm not sure.
Or not. Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Mona Sanderson, the bill.
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. The amendments, I think, do need some work in terms of the emergency clause and how it applies, and we've agreed that we'll work on that if the bill goes through the process. That's one issue. The other issue is I think that it is a valid for us to relook at the two clauses that refer to which policies are covered. And you'll find those on lines 5 through 9 of the amendments where it talks about an insurer offering health insurance. And then also on the second page of the amendments, lines 2 through 4, where it talks about health service contractors, which actually Regents is a health service contractor. And I believe that that those references would bring everyone under the application of the bill. But as the bill goes through the process, we will look at that. I have discussed some of the ways that legislative council has structured those references this session, and they agree that while it may technically do it, it is very difficult to read, and so I think they would also be amenable to clarifying and making sure everyone is covered.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Senator Mona Sanderson is bringing up those points. I think it's important. I guess, Mr. Chair,
when we heard this bill before, and we heard testimony from Regent saying basically this, if, with these amendments, this was in their book of business, and indeed that is probably true. So the question becomes at that point in time, if this is current practice, why mandate it? And that would be my issue.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Morrison.
Also, it was brought to my attention also that with new technology happening all of the time, we're mandating procedures that may, with future technology coming into play, there may be other screening devices that will be a whole lot cheaper and easier to administer than the one that we are mandating here, as I understand it.
I think that this is an important bill to kind of even the playing field, because I know it is provided by some carriers and not by others. I go back to the testimony by Senator Courtney discussing the cost of prevention, the small cost of prevention to the insurer and the large cost of treatment to the insurer. So I don't see this as a bill that is punitive, so to speak. Now, whether or not the rates go up is another issue, which, and they may, you know, if there is a ripple effect. I think the rates often go up twice as much as they need to as an excuse to raise the rates. But I think there are a lot of vital services that are not being covered. And so I just think it's the right thing to do. And I think the fixes that were discussed will occur along the way, because this bill will have discussion. Hopefully it will pass the Senate and go to the House and have a lot of discussion in the House. And hopefully it will come out of the House as a positive step toward covering more people. Further discussion.
Well, yes, thank you. You know, Mr. Chair, I guess the point is, when you mandate something, we aren't creating something that isn't already there. This is a purchasable service in the market now, and to mandate it doesn't make it cheaper. It just makes it more expensive for everybody, because now you have to have it whether you want it or not. You know, and none of the mandates that we have created, have we created something new. We've just required things that already exist. And if what we are truly attempting to do is control the cost of health care, this is not getting us there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. would you call the roll, Charles?
Yeah.
Senator Stark.
I am supporting this, and I guess I would like to get on record as to why I am. I agree, and it's a valid argument regarding mandate. On the other hand, I think that more attention will be paid to the public as the importance of this screening if it's covered for all. The cost savings will way offset any cost increases. The lives saved will be great. And I usually am opposed to most mandates, but this is one that I feel compelled to support, and we'll put that on the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other discussion? Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Mons Anderson?
No.
Senator Charles Starr?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye.
We're close, he says, but not that close.
Well, it would have been fine.
So moved. The bill will go to the floor, and Senator Cortin will be the carrier. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Part of feedback.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. We are going to open a public hearing. Close the work session. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 971. What are we?
The bill measure.
Oh, okay. Okay. 971 was on the agenda that shouldn't have been on the agenda because we dealt with it last time. We're going to open a public hearing on 782. Go ahead. Give a summary, please.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 782 requires the Department of Human Services to maintain a record for 24 months of all individuals terminated from public assistance. We did hear this on the 17th of March. DHS did testify as well as response to the bill. We only have one person here from the Department of Human Services that can answer questions about it. No one else has signed up.
Sue Abrams. Okay, thank you. I feel as if I know you're reading all the emails back and forth. Would you introduce yourself, please?
For the record, I'm Sue Abrams. I'm the administrator of the Office of Prevention and Transitional Benefits in the Children and Adults and Family section of the Department of Human Services. Okay. And we've been emailing back and forth, and so what I'm bringing here today and want to answer any questions you have is just kind of go over sort of the four areas where we think administratively we can do some things that won't have a fiscal impact or a large fiscal impact. So it may not go as far as you'd want, but we think we can do these things. And so one was in the area of notices. Now, we already have information on some of our notices that helps clients, directs them through some information around phone numbers, and lets them know that they can reapply if anything changes in their situation and where they can get information. What we're looking at is adding that to notices as we're able to do that as we change them. We have over 100 notices that we could send out. They're kind of canned notices. There's over 100. To change a notice, revise a notice, if we're not already going to revise it, I mean just to do it, if we were to do all 100 of them at one time, it's over about between $350 and $400 per notice to revise them because of our computer systems, because of the complexity, and because of translating all those notices. So all that costs money. So we're thinking to do it as we revise those notices would be a cost-effective way. And one of the things we could do is an assessment, because many of those, even though we have over 100 notices, many of them rarely get used. So there may be a group of them that are used often and that we do revise often that are going to hit the majority of clients. The other is information about our programs. And through the email process and responses from some of your staff, we do believe we could do a better job of helping people navigate that system. So we're going to take a look at working with our 800 number, which is where we direct people, which is really intended to be how you get an application. And the people who staff that are not supposed to, nor do they know the detailed information about program eligibility. So they really can't answer that. But we need to work with them so that they can direct the caller to the right area to get that information. And we can also put something, which we do on a lot of our notices. If people have questions, they're directed to call their local branch office and speak with the staff people at the local level who can answer those questions. So we need to make sure that we're getting people to that place rather than having somebody who really doesn't know any information, having them ask it and then not get the answers they need, and it's frustrating. So we would agree with that. The FEOP program is, I think there was just a misunderstanding. They are open and taking applications, and usually the eligibility decision is made within 30 days. So that's that's open to folks now. The outreach efforts, there's several things that we do around that. Again, the information we have on notices. And then as we've had experience with smaller programs, which is mainly in the SPD area, where we've closed them and then reopened them, we have done targeted outreach. The question came up, if you've got that system in place, why can't you do it with, why can't you do the bill, you know, follow the bill? And here's the dilemma. That was small and targeted, and we did it at one time. And we had a discrete population, and we knew that we reopened a program, and we knew what the criteria was. But ongoing, we're closing cases all the time, and we estimate, we have in the Medicaid program over 400,000 people on Medicaid, and we close about 5% of those a month. That would be 20,000 people. So that's where the expense comes in, developing some kind of database to store that, tracking them. If we're talking about tracking them for 24 months, I don't know what the numbers would be. I didn't do that in my head, but we'd have a huge database, and they would be closed for, and they would be come from a variety of different programs, because as you know, Medicaid has a variety of different programs. And so it would be, every time things changed, we would have to sort that out, figure out which ones we would contact. And as time goes on, the information that we had about that person would be old. They likely moved, you know, there's no way to get a hold of them. I think the SPD experience was different because it was a small population. It happened in a quick period of time, so we still knew where those folks were. And so we were able to get a hold of them. So that's where we're estimating our big cost would be, is that tracking, developing the system and tracking and getting a hold of people. And then, you know, trying to get a hold of people, actually, and not knowing how many we'd actually be able to contact. And then sorting through, again, so we don't frustrate people, because lots of times they don't like the government coming back. I mean, they may have closed because they're off and successful, and they're off our program, and here we are contacting them again. We may not even be matching with the right thing, because they might have closed for income, they might have closed because they moved out of state, they might have closed because children have left the home, and there's so many reasons why. Well, like I said, we have 100 different notices, so there's lots of reasons. So that's some of the complexity that causes it to be cost us money to do this for all of our closing.
Okay, now I guess I'm not quite sure where we are in relation to what this bill would require.
It would require us to have to track everybody that we close,
yeah. Okay.
And be able to then contact them when a program either eligibility or income level changes. And in many of our programs, it changes yearly because of the federal poverty level. Some of our programs are tied to that federal poverty level.
Okay.
So that's the challenge, the tracking part.
The parts of it that you said you could handle, well, I guess I'm still thinking of, in relation to a bill, how that would be, how we could fit that in without a fiscal. I guess what I'm saying is I would like to have statutory language that would require that you make an effort, and this would be a great performance measure, that you make an effort to contact people. I'd like to have it open-ended enough so there isn't a outcome requirement that you have to do unless you spend a lot of money, but that would give you a charge to work on, to do something. And statutory language is something that doesn't go away, that's there, that's something you would always have to pay attention to and always make an effort and try to expand that effort to reach a goal of keeping track of people. Is that, what do you think of that?
Well, Chair Morissette, you know, not having thought about that,
yeah.
Because, you know, our preference was to do this administratively, we could take a look at that and see if there's something that, I don't know if statutorily it makes sense to have something that says encourages us or supports us in improving those efforts.
Okay. If we... If you do the administrative rule, I guess what we could do is have you come back and report during the interim. We could always, we could keep you on a hook, and so to speak, and make sure that you, as long as I'm around or someone's around who's interested in this, to follow up on the administrative rule. Any thoughts on this?
Sure.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, I think I understand what you're after here, and it's a laudable goal. I guess I'm just looking at the dynamic of this session and the prioritization of what Department of Human Services already has on the table, and the fact that some of those things are in jeopardy, and to be adding new responsibilities on top of that, the timing may just not be right to do this. I mean, my sense is, I mean, clearly this would have to go down to Ways and Means, where they've already done their prioritization pretty much, and I'm not sure that dumping another requirement on top of what they're trying, the matrix they're trying to develop now, would necessarily be the right thing to do.
Well, I understand that, and on the other hand, this is an effort that's been made for the last 10 years to try to monitor what happens to people when they disappear, when they fall off the table. I mean, now, who's responsible? Whose responsibility is it? I guess you can make the argument that it is basically up to the people. On the other hand, you can say that some people need help. Do we know what happened to people when they leave the program? Now, in some local, in fact, in Lane County, they do some tracking, and I'm sure various AAA agencies probably do that. I know if we do send it to Ways and Means with any kind of a fiscal, if it's not already on a priority list, it's not going to be there. And I've had some discussion with the Ways and Means people, the co-chairs, about, you know, sending it to Ways and Means does not mean it's going to be assigned to the subcommittee, and once assigned to the subcommittee, if it's not on the priority list, it may not go anywhere. What do you have in mind as far as an administrative rule?
Chair Morissette, well, we would look at probably the rules that say what we need to have on our notices. But when I said administratively, I was talking about sort of some of the things we could do, like working with the 800 number to help. It's more of a training issue than an administrative rule. Changing our notices, I mean, I don't know all of the, we have millions of administrative rules. I'm sure we have something around notices, but that working towards putting a statement on there.
Uh-huh.
You know, also I failed to mention the kind of the, probably our biggest outreach effort when programs change is through the media and media releases. But also we have a lot of advocate organizations we work with that we work through, like food banks, like AAAs, like other entities where people who need our services often go, and we work with them, and I'm sure we can do more around providing them with information when a program changes or reopens. So it's those kinds of things, less so administrative rule, because those are things we don't usually put in an administrative rule, but we do administratively. So.
Okay, how would that be reflected, though, in, now, I think, immediately of performance measures?
Well, Chair Morissette, what I'm thinking is maybe what we could do is report back to you about all the things that we've actually accomplished and done. I'm not sure, you know, in terms of a performance measure, what...
Well, the purpose of a performance measure is to measure the quality of work that you're doing, not necessarily the quantity, but in some cases it's both, and to improve the service by saying, I am going to, and then you would enumerate the types of contacts that you would establish to see, and then try to measure their effectiveness, which may in itself be hard to do. You've made, you know, umpteen contacts, and a few people have responded. You would not know until after you've done it for a while. Okay, yes.
No, thank you, Chair. Another bill regarding people being cut off from Oregon Health Plan, there was a study done about what happened to those populations. Has your department Don, do you have access to or consider doing similar, even if it's a small, you know, test of people to see where they have actually ended up? Has that occurred with the department?
Chair Morissette and Mr. Verkhovian, I know of that study, although I couldn't off the top of my head tell you all of the things that have happened. We've done a study of TANF leavers and the impact on them, and we do know that less of them, after some period of time, many of them who leave get extended medical, but over some period of time they end up not coming back. And we do have a couple of pilots where we are looking at the reasons people are not coming back on the program, the Medicaid program. So we will eventually have some information about that. But any study, as you know, if we were, because we don't have the capacity to do a large study, any study like that, it would cost money. The TANF leaver study, we contracted out to a university, and I'm sure the Medicaid study costs money. But I think what we do have, and maybe Deanna can speak more to this, is that we did at least were able to have some numbers, and I have some of the numbers here in terms of when we terminated or ended the GA program and then we brought it back, albeit a much smaller program because it was stricter eligibility. We knew how many people we closed and how many people came back. So that kind of information we can provide, but it's on a very small scale.
Okay. Lee Hazelwood, would you please come up here and tell us, this is your bill that you have been working for the last decade or more?
Joey, yeah.
And you've been listening to the discussion, and I'd like your reaction, please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I live in Staten, Oregon. Yes, I have been working on this since 1992, and I'm not going to repeat my slogan because I'm afraid it's going to happen again. But my concern is, what happens to people being cut out of service? Now, I know that they send notice to people, you may reapply at some time or other. I have a copy of somebody who's raised these questions, and I'll just repeat some problems I've gotten back with. The problem with instructions to call the 800 number does not seem to be the end of all one-stop information that the above instruction would make it out to be. I tried calling as a potential client, but the information wasn't very helpful. When I asked about other programs, the male voice at the other end started to reel out the names of the program without any explanation of what they were. He mentioned FEOP. For example, when I asked what that is, he didn't even tell me what the acronym stands for or give any information. Simply said, I can give you the phone number for FEOP. At no time was I offered the client handbook referred to below, and short a sophisticated person might be able to glean some information from pulling this line. Well, I suspect that the average caller has just been bumped off some program. It seems like a not very informative and discouraging layer of bureaucracy. Incidentally, the first time I called, although the second, I got a droning male voice that was so discouraging, this very sound, that I doubt many people would have gotten past it. Our OSP prisoners manning the line, this is quoting him, no, not me, and it's FEOP currently accepting new clients. Last session, FEOP was running radio public service announcements encouraging people to sign up at a time when it wasn't even accepting new clients. So it means to me that somewhere along the line, people being cut out of service need to know when they need more help or somebody they can get a hold of and not waiting 6 months or 3 months or a year or so to come back at her. So this is the reason why I've been fighting this since 1992. And I have no reflection on these young ladies here. I have copies of stuff where it's been run through their system and said no fiscal impact. And I know within reason that they're going to be here with the fiscal impact, even though it's a dollar. And so this fellow that I said checked all this out says this: for the life of me, I can't understand why adding a sentence such as, if your situation changes, for example, if your income drops or your health worsens, you may again be eligible and call 1-800 to check. Would that require another page? I don't think so. And they've been quoted here as, notices are revised and new notices created, we can add this type of language. You may apply at any time. You have the right to reapply at any time. How long would this take? Six months?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to close the public hearing, and I want you to go back in the corner somewhere and talk and see if some simple thing could be done that you're...
Mr. Chair, if I could, if all you, very simply, to add that language to a termination notice wouldn't cost any money, but the bill also calls for a record system.
Mm-hmm.
So, the first part of Section 2, I think, is, I would agree with you, it should be there.
Yeah.
And but it's Sub 2, I think, is where we run into... when we run into problems, because that's requiring them to compile stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, we're in the public hearing. Go off and talk about it, and we may come back on Thursday. Okay. Close the public hearing. Close the committee. We're
adjourned. Okay.
Wow. Same bill.